find yourself traveling along an old dirt road in your town, or even in a place you've never been, try to imagine the things that have happened there and who might have lived there. The dirt road you're thinking of might be tree-lined, bordered by thick forests and hills with swamps on either side. Or maybe it stretches off forever in a straight line through a dusty desert. Your imagination probably doesn't take you to actors, rock stars, and even drug traffickers. But there's a reason they say truth is stranger than fiction. My name is Anthony Cerdelli. I'm a journalist. Well, a sports journalist, living in Southern California. I'm about to tell you a story about the dirt road in Vermont that I grew up on. When I found out the truth behind the urban legends about this small part of Sharon, Vermont, the place where I spent a lot of my childhood, my mind was blown. This is True Stories from an Old Dirt Road. Welcome to a bonus episode of True Stories from an Old Dirt Road. I hope you like the podcast so far, but there's one more place, a little bit down the old dirt road, about a mile, that belongs in this story. It's called the Lake Mitchell Trout Club. The Lake Mitchell Trout Club lies off the old dirt road in Sharon, shortly before the Norwich town line. It's a private club, and not just anyone can fish there, because the lake lies entirely within the land the club owns. The Trout Club is pretty quaint. It's comprised of an old house, more on that in a bit. When you walk down past the house to the lake, you'll see a covered dock with a few rowboats moored to it. But, much like the history of the road it's found off of, the appearance of the Trout Club belies a fascinating history. Remember this rumor?
There's another thing another legend that I believe is true. I can't put time and dates to it because it was long before my time, but there's a story that former President William Howard Taft had to be rescued from one of the bathtubs because of his his surplus of weight causing him to get stuck in the tub and not be able to get out.
Taft's bathtub debacle is actually a common urban legend, only it's usually about him getting stuck in the White House bathtub, which has been disproven. But who knows? Maybe Taft did actually visit the Trout Club, although I can't find any evidence to prove he did. Still, like the other legends on this road, there is an element of truth to this rumor. Before we delve into it, I want to introduce you to a couple of voices you're going to hear in this episode. They are Ken Parker and Stephen Wood. The voice you heard telling the story about Taft belongs to Ken Parker. He's the second longest active member of the Lake Mitchell Trout Club, having joined in 1983. You're also going to hear from Stephen Wood. He's been a member since 2004 and has been working on documenting the history of the Trout Club. In my conversations with Stephen and Ken, I was able to learn more details about the incredible history that the Trout Club has on its own, which fits in well with the other things that have happened over the years on the old dirt road. The Lake Mitchell Trout Club's founding members established the club in the late 19th century, after having left another exclusive fishing club nearby. Here's Ken Parker.
Lakota was, I believe, the first one, and it was formed by a group of well-to-do businessmen in the Woodstock area, or who frequented the Woodstock area. Franklin Billings, for instance, was one of the founding members. And over the years, Lawrence Rockefeller was a member, and there are a number of other notable folks who lived in that area. But they had a club that they started with a very limited membership. And from what I understand, there were people in the area that wanted to become a member of the Trout Club, but they either weren't accepted or there weren't openings in Woodstock area at the Lakota Club. So they decided to form a club of their own, which became the Lake Mitchell Trout Club.
Stephen added some more on the formation of the Trout Club.
The building was completed in 1898, and it was that year that the original five members solicited 45 new members and started the 50 member tradition. The dam had been completed in 1892, and the site is that of an old farm. The barn, I believe, predates the lodge.
And the lodge was built, someone told me the lodge was built from like old ponderosa pines that were shipped from the west, from like the west coast, or what do you know? Would you happen to know?
I've heard the same thing, but I have never seen anything that would confirm that. And I've been in the building before with people who know wood and the grain of wood and that kind of thing better than me. And that's what they have also said. Oh, wow. Where did they find these ponderosa pine here in New England? It is kind of a 19th century experience with some 21st century upgrades, or maybe 20th century upgrades.
The Trout Club grew out of a different private fishing club, the Lakota Club, in nearby Barnard, Vermont. As you heard Ken Parker say, the Lakota Club's members were pretty influential people in that era. First, there was Franklin S. Billings, who served as the 60th governor of Vermont from 1925 to 1927. Later on, Lawrence Rockefeller, son of John D. Rockefeller, who carved out his own reputation as an influential businessman and conservationist, was also a member of the club. When the former members of the Lakota Club split off to start the Lake Mitchell Trout Club in Sharon, they took some of that influence along with them, which most likely led to the first fascinating part of this story. Remember that thing Ken said about William Howard Taft? Well, I wasn't able to find any evidence that Taft visited the club or got stuck in the bathtub there, but another U.S. president did visit. That was Vermont native and the 30th president of the United States, Calvin Coolidge. Coolidge was an avid fisherman and a native of Plymouth Notch, Vermont, not that far from Sharon. Coolidge visited in June of 1929, just a few months after he left office. Though there weren't any details about his visit, there is proof in the form of two letters he sent to Henry Brooks, a member of the Trout Club. Ken sent me pictures of the letters. The first was dated July 5th, 1929. I'm not going to even try to do a Calvin Coolidge imitation, so just please use your imagination. I am very much pleased to know that I am an honorary member of the Lake Mitchell Trout Club. I was up there in June and I had the most enjoyable time. Mr. Stone was very kind in his attentions. I hope to get there again this summer. With kindest regards, I am very truly yours, Calvin Coolidge. The next letter was dated August 24th, 1929. Dear Mr. Brooks, it is with much regret that I have to report that I cannot be present at the annual dinner of the Lake Mitchell Trout Club. I should like all the more to go because I found the clubhouse and the surroundings made such a beautiful setting that they will always call one to return. I wish you would express my gratitude to the members for their great courtesy to me, and I hope that they may always enjoy the club as much as I have. With kindness regards, I am very truly yours, Calvin Coolidge. So who was Henry Stanford Brooks, the person who Calvin Coolidge was writing to? I can't find that much about him. He was clearly a member of the Trout Club and influential enough to know or correspond with the president. But there isn't that much else I can find about him. According to what I think is his obituary, he was born in 1864 in Chinese Camp, California, the son of a mining engineer who owned a gold mine. He went to Yale and then Columbia Law School. He died 9 years after Coolidge's visit to the Trout Club and was buried at Riverside Cemetery in Woodstock, Vermont. Regardless of who invited him, the fact that a president of the United States fished in this small private pond on this rural dirt road, which back in 1929 must have been even more remote, is incredible. That's not even close to everything that's gone on at the Trout Club. The next story from the Trout Club occurs in 1966 and is also 100% true. In fact, it's documented in the spring 2006 edition of Dartmouth Medicine, a, quote, magazine for alumni and friends of Dartmouth Medical School and Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center. The article, written by Seymour E. Wheelock, M.D., and Roger P. Smith, Ph.D., is called Wild Greens. The story begins on a warm spring afternoon on the first day of May in 1966. That's when Dr. William Dumps McCarty Jr., a Dartmouth-Hitchcock radiologist, his wife Harriet and son Billy McCarty III, who was a Dartmouth student, along with Billy's friend John Schumacher, Dr. Jackson Wright, another Dartmouth-Hitchcock doctor, and his wife Margaret, were all eating lunch at the Trout Club. Along with them were the caretakers of the Trout Club, Gertrude and Erland Kimball. Soon after lunch, they were still sitting at the table. Erland Kimball and Dr. Wright passed out. Dr. McCarty and his wife, and Dr. Wright's wife, Margaret all got sick and started vomiting. Realizing something was horribly wrong, Dr. McCarty drove them to the ER at the Mary Hitchcock Medical Center in Hanover, which obviously was much smaller than today's Dartmouth-Hitchcock ER. Dr. McCarty, worrying his son and his son's friend would soon also fall ill, drove back to the Trout Club to pick them up and deliver them to the hospital. Meanwhile at the ER, which was already full, the staff called in the cavalry. A pediatrician, Dr. Seymour Wheelock, who was on call for the poison control. Pharmacologist, Dr. Robert Gosselin, who specialized in toxic substances. James Poole, a Dartmouth botany professor, and a cardiologist, Dr. Donald Andreessen. The patients, some semi-conscious and still vomiting, had abnormally low blood pressure and an unusually slow heartbeat, which was odd because according to the author, when someone's blood pressure drops a lot, their heart starts beating faster to try to increase it. But that wasn't happening. The doctors gave them fluids and ephedrine to increase their heart rate. And they did another thing. This part is where my imagination goes wild, when it probably shouldn't. All the facts in this story are being told in a medical journal by a doctor, so it's pretty matter of fact. Anyway, they gave the patients atropine. I am definitely not a doctor, but I should have a PhD in action movies. And if any of you love action movies as much as I do, you might recognize atropine. It was used in two very intense and kind of gross scenes in the movie The Rock to counteract the effects of a poison gas attack. The scenes gave me nightmares the first time I saw it when I was a kid. Here it is in case you forgot, with Nick Cage in all his glory. Just so you know, the scene does have some R-rated language.
Tell them to take the atropine now.
The atropine, Isherwood.
What?
Where's my water? 1 minute!
More of the atropine now!
Inject it in your heart before your suit melts.
Shit.
They can take it too.
Where's that water?
Get that away from me.
They'll fix it, for Christ's sake. Take the atropine now, Stan, for Christ's sake.
For those who haven't seen The Rock, and because you can't see it during a podcast, you might think that taking atropine might be preferable to being melted by a corrosive gas and then blown up. But in this movie, the syringe they have to inject into their heart is enormous. Also, I don't think atropine would protect you from being melted by a poisonous gas. I also doubt any of the patients from the Trout Club had a comically large syringe jabbed in their hearts, but who knows? Anyway, back to the real story. For some reason, Dr. McCarty didn't take Erland Kimball to the ER on his first trip. When Kimball's frantic wife called that same ER to help him, they sent Gosselin and Wheelock in an ambulance to retrieve him. The ride was hair-raising, to say the least. The following is a passage read directly from the Wild Greens article. The Lake Mitchell Trout Club was only 9 miles from the hospital in Hanover. The road was paved for the 2 miles into the village of Norwich. Then came the 5.5, largely unpaved miles on Beaver Meadow Road, plus another 2 miles on Mitchell Brook Road and Mitchell Lake Road, both completely unpaved. The route, then and now, has scarcely a straightaway anywhere, and the descent into Beaver Meadow Village is still hair-raisingly precipitous. On the way out, Gosselin and Wheelock both sat in the front with the driver. As a senior physician, Seymour rode in the front with the driver, Gosselin said, and I found myself in the back sitting beside the patient, or more accurately, trying to sit beside the patient while being hurtled back and forth in the speeding vehicle. The patient was at least strapped down. I was not. Even though he was sitting in the front of the ambulance, Wheelock didn't have a great ride back to the hospital either. The ambulance sped along with its interior lights on, and I, who have a history of debilitating car sickness, was rendered nearly incapacitated by violent vertigo, Wheelock said. In the meantime, Dr. McCarty picked up his son and his son's friend from the Trout Club and drove them back to Hanover, where the hospital and the college was. Both students said they felt fine and went back to their dorms to study for exams, before McCarty, worried they might still get sick, called them and told them to get to the ER right away. Which was a good thing, because they did get sick. So what happened? It turned out to be a mass poisoning. Harriet McCarty was an accomplished cook and liked to use wildflowers and wild herbs in her cooking. Unfortunately, she misidentified a plant she used to cook that day, which turned out to be a big mistake. What she thought was southern pokeweed, something she ate as a kid growing up in Maryland, was unfortunately not southern pokeweed. It was actually a plant identified by the Dartmouth botanist James Poole as Indian poke, which also goes by the name corn lily or false hellebore. If you live in central New Hampshire or Vermont, you've probably seen it growing next to a brook or a river. It's got longer, kind of oval-shaped green leaves that are pointy at the end and kind of ribbed. That's what they ate. And it's very, very poisonous. According to the article, the doctors were already familiar with the plant because it had been used in various medical trials as a blood pressure medication since it was so good at lowering blood pressure. But the trials were discontinued because it caused users to vomit at effective doses. With the plant identified and the treatment working, all patients eventually recovered, but not before causing a harrowing afternoon at the Mary Hitchcock ER. You might be wondering why Gertrude Kimball didn't get sick. According to the article, Gertrude, upon seeing the plant Harriet McCarty was asking her to prepare, made a wise decision. "The cows won't eat that stuff," the article quoted her as saying. "I don't eat anything the cows won't eat." And she didn't. There's one more story that I know of that went down at the Trout Club, and this one is pretty intense as well. And they both mentioned some sort of attempted robbery and murder by some Hell's Angels who had met, I guess, the caretaker of the Trout Club at the Sap Bucket Lounge or whatever it was called.
Yeah, it's quite a bit of what you have just related that I don't think is accurate. His name was Mike. He and his wife were caretakers in about the era of 1979 to 83. And unfortunately, the wife had some mental health issues, and she was occasionally committed to either the Brattleboro Retreat or the state hospital in Waterbury. She was not well. Mm-hmm. And on one occasion, she was in an institution, and he was at the club working as a caretaker, and he went down to South Royalton to a bar. And I don't remember the name of the bar, but I think it's in a building that it was in a building that's still there, and I think it's still a bar. Oh. But anyway, he went down there and he was drinking, and there were a couple of guys that were in the bar, and I don't know if he bought them drinks or if they bought him drinks or what it was. I've never heard that they were tied to any motorcycle gang. Certainly, because I've never heard anything whatsoever about Hell's Angels. But they were there. They were a rather rowdy bunch. And they had some drinks, and he invited them back up to the club, from what I'm told or remember, to play cards and have a couple of nightcaps. Well, they got up to the club and they apparently decided that they ought to rob him, which they did. And they beat him pretty significantly with the large iron poker that's used for the fireplace in the great room. He managed to escape into the woods. And when he did, they took some newspaper and bunched it up and put it on top of the stove in the kitchen and lit it. And then they made their escape out of the area. He was able to get back in the building, even though he'd been injured with the beating that he had taken, and was able to put out the fire. Subsequent to that, Dr. Sam Doyle was the president at the time. He called a meeting of the board, and this was, I think, in 1983. Called a meeting of the board and summarily fired Mike for lack of having anybody that they could turn to be a caretaker. He suggested that his son, Rick, fill in at the club on an interim basis. Interim turned out to be 28 years.
Well, there you have it. Three more stories from the old dirt road that present an even more fascinating history of the neighborhood. The more I tell these stories and think about them myself, the more I think about what's changed and what hasn't changed in this part of Vermont. In the almost 38 years since I was born, and the decades since I've lived in Sharon, not much has changed on that old dirt road. Today it looks much like it did in my earliest memories. There's an old wagon wheel out front of the house I grew up in, which was there during the drug trafficking stories. It was referenced in the police report, and possibly even longer. The pond is newer. It didn't exist during the DeWilda days, but it did during the drug bust and when I was born. As you drive the road, you don't see new construction or new subdivisions or any sign that rural is becoming suburban or even less rural, which is cool. It makes me wonder how far back it looked this way and what other stories might be hidden or preserved over the years. If you enjoyed this podcast, please give it a good rating, maybe a good review. I'm considering doing another season, but I'm still undecided. If you have any more stories I should look into about this part of Vermont, please email me at ciardellia@gmail.com. That's ciardellia@gmail.com. Thanks again. I hope you enjoyed True Stories from an Old Dirt Road.